Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 9th of April. It's All Things Political, which you always hear Mondays at 9. Clarence Page is our guest this morning, one of my favorite All Things Political guests. He is joining us from the studios of NPR, where we had the great pleasure of chatting with him in person about a year ago. Great trip that was. He is a Pulitzer Prize winner for commentary. He's a columnist syndicated nationally by Tribune Media Services, a member of the Chicago Tribune's editorial board, a regular contributor of essays to the NewsHour. He has contributed regularly to the Chris Matthews Show, ABC's Nightline, and BET's Lead Story. He's author of Showing My Color, Impolite Essays on Race and Identity, and you can see his columns online. He wrote about To Kill a Mockingbird, which turned 50, and it was shown on television on Saturday, wasn't it? I watched part of it, but not all of it. I'll have to continue. He also has written about the Trayvon Martin case. He's written about life lessons learned from sad lotto winners. He's been looking very carefully at the Affordable Health Care Act arguments before the Supreme Court, and you can talk to Clarence about just about anything. And we'll welcome phone calls for him. The number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email address, if you would care to use that, is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Hi, Clarence.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for having me back.
Always a pleasure. You didn't win the lotto, but you would have gone to work anyhow, right?
Of course. I could never do without work. My goodness. I don't think you'd be talking to me now except long distance from Key West or something.
Right. I was wondering why you wrote about it, though. I thought this guy must have entered the lotto. Did you think about it? Did you enter it?
I hate the lotto on so many different levels, I got to tell you. For one thing, number one, I've never won it. Number two, it's a reverse tax that lures people in.
Yes.
In inverse proportion to their income. It's one of the slickest kind of taxes government can do, which is okay, except that it feeds bad habits, the kind of habits I've been trying to get rid of over the years, like you know eating, smoking, and gambling, things like that. So it's like, but on top of that, it's the benefits are way overestimated. Folks think that every time there's a school problem, they say, what about the lotto? That's supposed to pay for the schools. It's such a drop in the bucket. It's like saying, why can't we balance the budget by cutting foreign aid? But anyway, now that I've finished beating up the lottery, it's a great segue for me to a philosophical column musing on the fact that there are so many people who get publicized because they win the lottery. But what about those who win the lottery and lose ultimately? There are so many bad news stories. I just recounted a couple of them in my column. There's others you can easily find on the web if you just Google phrases like sad lottery stories. there's many of them of people who blew the money that they won and turned out to have a couple of tragic cases. Goodness, one man committed suicide out of depression over all that he had lost, and there were so many others who declared bankruptcy and just ran into all kinds of problems because once they got all this money, they really had no idea of the kind of impact that it has on you. So if you do win the lottery, go out and get yourself a good financial counselor. Number one.
Thank you, Clarence.
And plan ahead because, easy come, easy go, it really shows itself. But the bottom line of my column, though, is that there are so many stories of people who get rich by all kinds of ways, mostly legal, fortunately, but still aren't happy. And the kids are miserable and the family's miserable at all. And in the end, they wind up saying, gee, if only I had more time. You can't buy any more time. Time to be with your family, time to raise your kids right, time to appreciate life.
Isn't that the truth? Time is what becomes all important, as those of us who are getting older realize completely.
Yep.
Completely.
Yep. And as I get older, believe me, I have found that, a raise is nice. If you could give me an extra week off, that'd be
right.
I personally feel that would be even more valuable just because it's so, give you a chance to actually enjoy life and not just keep working to make the money to afford it.
I was so delighted you wrote about my favorite film of all time, To Kill a Mockingbird, and the president introducing the film. I saw half of it on Saturday, but not all of it. You say in your column you admire Lee's work as a masterpiece of subversion. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's tough to. I can tell you as a columnist who deals in controversial issues, it's tough first of all to get people to read you who don't agree with you. It's a real triumph because in this day and age, folks like to turn to the TV news station or the publication that will just feed their own prejudices rather than challenge their thinking. One thing about Harper Lee and Mark Twain that makes them two of my favorite writers is that they knew how to draw you into a story on an issue as touchy as race. Huckleberry Finn and To Kill a Mockingbird are two examples of stories that seem, they start off like they're just pleasant, witty, humorous little stories, one centering on a kid named Huck Finn, another one on this little girl, Scout. Scout is telling this story about her father, who's a local lawyer. They're in this small town in Alabama, and it turns out that her father winds up defending this black man who is obviously innocent of this rape charge, his charge of raping a white woman in front of an all-white jury. And it's just this classic, really, what gothic southern story unfolds that gives you such a portrait of injustice in a system where there's nobody particular to blame for this. It is part of the system. The people, these men on this jury, you get the idea that they really, they know this man is innocent, but if they were to let him go, it's like the whole system, the whole way of life, the customs and traditions of this whole region would just collapse. Everything that they believe in and their families, et cetera, et cetera. It's such a well-layered tale, just on the surface, as you mentioned, the characters are wonderful. Mm-hmm. The settings are great. Harper Lee's writing is just superb and swift, and it's easy for any age to read. But it is so layered insofar as the inner lives of these characters that it's a very American story, like Moby Dick and so many others. And it's one of the greatest bestsellers, biggest bestsellers of all time. It's still a big seller. It's towns like cities like Chicago, when they started their Read a Book program some years ago, they try to get every kid in town to read one book, the same book. They chose Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird as the first book of that program, and it was very successful. And because both the book and the movie, which she had a financial stake in as well, and she praised after it was produced, starring Gregory Peck, for the great job they did of staying close to her book. And how many authors do you hear say that?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. I think anybody who's read the book and seen the movie, I think would agree that as Hollywood movies go, it's very, very close to the book and really well done.
And both masterpieces. And you end your column by bringing it to 2012, and this is a story that will be with us again this week, as it was ever since it happened. One time Atticus said, "You never really knew a man until you stood in his shoes and walked around in them. It's a message worth remembering. As we search through the facts in pursuit of truth in the Trayvon Martin story."
Yeah, I think that the Trayvon Martin story is an interesting one to me. I also mentioned the O.J. Simpson story in between there because, to me, first of all, the O.J. Simpson case was so shocking to America because, for one thing, it turned the whole scenario of To Kill a Mockingbird on his head. On its head. Here you have a wealthy black man being exonerated or being found not guilty. There's a difference there. by a mixed race jury, and it was all on television. Split screen, we saw black folks responding with delight that a black man had gotten a fair trial, and whites responding with horror that the killer of two innocent people may have walked away free. And this, I think, was, to me, and I could write a book about this, maybe someday I will, I think, with the O.J. Simpson double homicide verdict, in many ways, America's whole, the whole civil rights scene lost its innocence, if you will. The complexities of life stepped in, complexities of modern life. Now, the one odd, strange, ironic advantage of the old school racism and racial etiquette was it was pretty cut and dry, black and white. No pun necessary. Compared to today, where there's so many shades of gray, we still haven't gotten, we still haven't bridged this cultural gap, this communications gap between black and white America. And we're seeing that pop up with the Trayvon Martin case, that we have many folks talking past each other. I saw Shelby Steele, a terrific black conservative writer, opined in the Wall Street Journal last week on Trayvon Martin case and used it as an opportunity to beat up on Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton for race hustling around this issue, completely ignoring the central issue of the controversy, which is why hasn't George Zimmerman, the accused killer of Trayvon Martin, been arrested? Because there's so much evidence here that would justify some kind of further investigation. That's why you've got thousands of people in the street. It's not because Jesse Jackson or Al Sharpton had to go out and hustle up public demand. It was the family of Trayvon Martin and the outrage of many African Americans at what they see as justice denied, and that's the issue to focus on. Love it or hate it, that's the real issue here. But we're talking past each other in modern America because we got so many old grudges against people like Jesse Jackson mm-hmm. or Al Sharpton mm-hmm. or whoever else you want to name.
Do you think, and we just don't have this conversation in this country, and there's been so much gun violence recently, do we have to take on the issue of guns because Zimmerman had a gun and was this self-appointed security guy who had a gun? And we've seen cases all over the country, the case in Oklahoma over the weekend, a case here in Wisconsin, where people have guns, stand your ground, the Castle Doctrine, whatever it is. Do you think it's going to be seriously examined?
Well, it's already happening. You know, the stand your ground law, which was first passed in Florida about 6-7 years ago now. I guess it was 2005. Governor Jeb Bush signed it into law. And at the time, it was hotly opposed by prosecutors, police, as well as gun control advocates, because it shifted the balance and the burden of proof so drastically that it became almost impossible to prosecute someone for shooting somebody else once they claim justifiable homicide. And that we've seen this happen now in Florida. The St. Petersburg paper, I believe it was St. Petersburg Times, I guess it is, found that the numbers of justifiable homicide cases in Florida tripled after the after Stand Your Ground went into effect. Now, the St. Petersburg paper ran this story a couple of years ago, but now it's been revived because of the Trayvon Martin case, because we see the worst case scenario has unfolded here now, where a man is not even thoroughly investigated because of Stand Your Ground. The prosecutors and police are so reluctant now to even prosecute a case like this or even to thoroughly investigate a case like this that we found Trayvon Martin's case just kind of lay there until his parents came forth. And I ended my column with a comment from Larry Wilmore, the quote senior black correspondent unquote of the Daily Show, who said that we don't want I believe, Kathleen, you've got the column in front of you right now,
don't
you?
Yeah, I'm trying to find it. I always have so many papers. Hold on.
Sorry, I didn't know you were going to ask me about this, because every time I write a column, as you know, I forget about it and move on to the next column.
I know, it's like I read the books.
There's always some... Which one
do you want to reference?
Larry Wilmore, down at the bottom of the column, he had said that we don't want to have trial not mob rule, but by the public... by the public jury anyway, but the bottom line is that if that's the only jury you've got, then it makes sense to turn to that court. And that was what happened with the case of the parents of Trayvon Martin, that they weren't getting a hearing in conventional court, so they had to turn to the public court by way of their lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really what the core of that controversy is. And why in this day and age, we have to ask, does that kind of thing have to happen? On top of that, now we've got the new prejudices, as I call them, for those of us who've got parents of young black males, as I do. You know how that the young black male is the most feared creature on American streets today, unless they're wearing a prep school uniform. And now we're learning that the hoodie now is a special,
yes,
intimidating costume for a young black male to wear. And some people, judging by the emails I get, seem to think that if a black kid is wearing a hoodie now, they're just inviting themselves to get shot, which is much like telling a woman if you wear a short skirt, you're inviting sexual assault.
Right.
It just doesn't make sense, but it shows how much our emotions have run away with us around these issues.
Mm-hmm. One more area, and then we'll go to phone calls. Affordable health care. You move in circles that we don't there in Washington, D.C., Clarence. What are you hearing about what the Supreme Court, what was underneath their questioning of affordable health care, how this is going to affect the presidential race, whether or not it's 5-4, what does that do to our perception of the Supreme Court? If it is 5-4, do we prefer that it be 6-3? What do you think?
Well, in recent years, we have found the Supreme Court has, during their questioning, actually been more substantive than for a long time. We know that the justices have pretty well made up their minds before they even start questioning, because they've already read the briefs, they've already had discussions with their clerks and research, etc. And in this particular case, in a nutshell, it looked like the way the questioning went that the justices, the conservative wing, was very they're very skeptical of whole what Obamacare, as it's being called now, even by President Obama, and that Justice Kennedy is the swing vote. He's become the swing vote on the court these days, and he's a conservative leaning justice. And his questioning was particularly skeptical about the mandate, which requires everyone to have some health insurance coverage, and if you're too poor to afford it, the government will subsidize and help you to be able to afford to buy it. But everybody has to buy it, and so the question comes down to whether or not government has the right to force you to buy a private sector commodity. Justice Kennedy sounded very skeptical of this, but then near the end of his questioning, I noticed that he sounded like he was trying to find justifications for it, because he was acknowledging that insurance is a different kind of commodity than broccoli, for example, which Justice Scalia sarcastically brought up, or any other commodity that government might ask you to buy. So I think he was searching for a good argument in favor of the Obamacare setup and the mandate, which, if the mandate collapses, Justice Scalia, his wing of the court, would like to just dismantle all of Obamacare. I think Justice Kennedy was very skeptical of that, because it would have such far-reaching consequences. And the thing is, if Justice Kennedy comes up with a good argument in favor of Obamacare and the current mandate arrangement, I think that would move Justice Roberts to support him, because mm-hmm. Justice Roberts, like all Supreme Court chief justices, would like to, hates 5-4 decisions. You want at least 6-3 in order to show that the case really has some weight to it and credibility. Brown versus Board, that case, the Chief Justice worked hard to get a unanimous decision and got it. And even then, there were many states that didn't want to comply with school desegregation. So I think that's the more optimistic view of what the justices have decided. And they have decided. We know that. It's just a question of them coming up with their final opinions, which we won't hear until June.
We welcome phone calls. Clarence Page is our guest this hour for All Things Political. He is columnist, Tribune Media Services, syndicated, member of the editorial board, and, of course, a commentator you see widely on public television and on MSNBC and many other places. Joining us from the studios of NPR in Washington, here is our phone number. We have yet to get to some of the current presidential campaign issues. The Republicans, it looks like Romney is the nominee. We'll ask Clarence about that. We'll talk about the jobs numbers not being what some economists had hoped they would be for last month, why that's the case. And I guess we have to talk about the price of gasoline. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Lines are open for you right now. The email is talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program this morning. This is National Library Week, and we will be speaking with the Verona Library Director and the Vice President of Grantmaking and Community Initiative for the Madison Community Foundation about the importance of libraries. And that's hour number two of our show. Clarence Page is All Things Political guest this Monday. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. And we start our calls with Jim in Milwaukee. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I'd like to talk today about Christianity and prejudice and selectivity in avoiding the subtleties of crime. And, as a Christian, we're supposed to love our neighbor as ourselves. And to do that, we have to discover our sinfulness and then repent of it and then finally try to do something to implement justice in the world. And it's in the case of minority crimes, it's kind of easy to see it. The armed robber is right there in your face, has a gun in your face, and it's easy to see. Whereas people will overlook the subtleties, for example, of white crime. Willie Sutton, for example, when asked why he robbed banks, he said that's where the money is. And it gets into even more subtle things, for example, in the area of pollution. We know that because of climate change and the spread of insects to different areas, that there's more spraying of chemicals. And the pollution from those chemicals poison the water, and then they poison humans, and the humans get cancer, and they get further poisoned with chemotherapy. And we see them suffer, and we suffer ourselves in seeing their debilitating sicknesses. And all of this happens because somebody made a decision to put pollutants into the environment and make people suffer, and it's easy to see the crime when a poor person sticks a gun in your face, but the subtleties of pollution taking people's lives is something that escapes our perception, and so we have difficulty in putting things together with white crime because it's not as easy to see.
Clarence.
Yeah, I think he's right. There's a lot of visibility and makes a lot of difference with how we perceive crime and also, how we perceive morality. We tend to judge other people more harshly than ourselves because we know ourselves better. I'm a moral, fair-minded, even-handed person, but that guy over there, I'm not so sure about him. We tend to color our perceptions this way. No pun intended or no pun necessary, but we tend to color our perceptions based on our experiences, and all of our experiences are so different. I was watching on last night on CNN. Anderson Cooper has a series about children and race, and they're looking at the race perceptions of kids and showing them different pictures of different. These were different cartoon drawings of different children in different situations, and the only differences between them were that the races were reversed from one situation to the next. They found that black kids tended to judge the harsh kids, judge the white kids more harshly. White kids judge the black kids more harshly. But that this came about mostly around age 13 when they became teenagers. As younger kids, they truly are remarkably colorblind, and their perceptions of race change as they get older, and their experiences, and you know, if they experience rejection from somebody because of race or somebody's parents, all of these experiences will make a difference. And I think that in our experience, when you say the word crime, people think of a bank robber like Willie Sutton. They don't think of a polluter. But if they've criminally polluted, that's a crime too.
Thanks, Jim, as always, for your Monday calls. Pat in Wausau, hi.
Hey, guys. I might be a touch off topic now, but my comment was on the Supreme Court case, and just had a question for your guest. It seemed like the majority of the feedback on the news after the 3-day hearing was that the legal counsel for the administration had a couple of pretty bad days. I think Jeffrey Tobin, I was listening to, who I believe is the legal expert on CNN, kind of comes from the progressive side, even described it as a plane wreck one day and a train wreck the other day. My question is, didn't the president kind of exasperate matters when he went out then the following week and, you know, basically attacked the court while they're presiding over this case? It just seems to me, you know, he's looking for a ruling one way here and going out and attacking the very same people who are then going to be making the actual ruling was not only unprecedented, but a little bit stupid.
Fair question. Clarence?
Yeah, it is a fair question. And it's not unprecedented for presidents to attack the court by any means. I mean, Franklin Roosevelt, certainly, he went to war with the courts and was accused of court packing and stacking, et cetera. But I think that President Obama, if he was being totally candid, would say that he misspoke and came out more harshly against the court than he really meant to sound. He is a constitutional lawyer, a constitutional law professor. He knows that the Supreme Court members have already made up their minds. They're not likely to say, well, I'm going to go back into that room now and turn against Obamacare. He knows what's going on over there at the Supreme Courthouse. But I think he was talking more to the public, and as such began to use some of the, what he meant to do was to say that the conservative members of Congress and other conservatives who were criticizing Obamacare and hoping the court would overturn it, that they were doing what they so often accuse the Supreme Court of doing, which is being an unelected body that is making legislative decisions. That's the kind of thing that President Obama wanted to say. Instead, he sounded like he himself was accusing the Supreme Court of being an unelected body. So it's the kind of situation in which I think President Obama now sees that Obamacare could be in trouble, and if so, he's laying the groundwork for what's going to come afterwards.
Thanks, Pat, very much. We have lines open if you'd like to join our conversation. Clarence Page is the guest for All Things Political, and our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Let's talk a little bit, Clarence, about Mitt Romney, who appears to have this nomination pretty much sewn up. And the Republicans seem to be facing a real problem with women right now. I've heard 18-point gender gap. What do the Republicans need to do to narrow that? Because they really have to narrow that.
I'm not sure, Kathleen. You know, you're absolutely right. And I've been thinking about that, too, because while the Republicans, on the whole, the candidates and the party, want to focus attention on the economy because they know that's where President Obama right now is most vulnerable. Instead, public attention keeps getting shifted over to these gender issues. Rick Santorum himself led the charge on the whole question of contraception and the ethics and morality of it. He focused attention on the fact that he's very much against choice on the abortion issue. He gave the perception that he would like to outlaw contraceptives, which is not true, and he's said this repeatedly. He doesn't want to outlaw them. He just doesn't like them. Then you've got Rush Limbaugh and his ridiculous, really downright slanderous attack on a woman who testified up on Capitol Hill in favor of contraceptive coverage under Obamacare and other insurance policies, even at religiously affiliated institutions like Georgetown, where she is a law student. You know, these are legitimate issues, and women are finding themselves ridiculed for advocating something like what that young woman advocated. And it goes on. This has been, most recently, Reince Priebus, the Republican chairman, said that there's no war against women. It's like saying there's a war against caterpillars. And the Democrats, I mean, it was a legitimate metaphor. He wasn't trying to be sexist, obviously. It might have sounded stupid, but he wasn't trying to be sexist. In any case, Democrats pounced on those remarks and saying, he's calling women caterpillars. The Democrats are obviously taking advantage of the fact that Republicans have been kind of knocked back on their heels in regard to the women's vote. And the fact that women in this latest Gallup poll have turned so heavily against the Republican potential nominee, while the male vote is still pretty even 50-50, That is dangerous for Republicans. Women tend to vote more often they have a higher turnout than men do. With those kind of numbers, if that holds up into November, that would doom the Republican nominee.
And what about the economy for the president? The jobs numbers were disappointing last month. Is that problematic for the president if we get another month and another month with fewer than 200,000 jobs created?
Yeah, it's a slow recovery, and that's been the story all along. The economy has been steadily recovering since President Obama's inauguration, but it's been too slow to have that big of a dramatic impact on, say, the average family. The fact it's moving in the right direction is positive for him. It helped Franklin Roosevelt during the Depression to get reelected. If it's not recovering fast enough, that is a very strong issue for Mitt Romney, and he's been playing it very heavily, saying that President Obama is a good man, he's just over his head. And by pushing that, as long as the economy is not recovering any faster than it is, then he's got a chance. But, you know, we're not really going to know until September. Those jobs numbers are going to be the most important ones for the impression that voters take into the voting booth with them.
Rodney in Johnson Creek. Hi.
Good morning.
Hi, Rodney.
My question to you is, what do you feel the current situation is with information the government has, both science, political, foreign affairs? And they seem to scream through their buddies in media what we get. And a lot of people are just either not inclined, lazy, or whatever their case is, don't do the further investigation to find out sources of information from people that are not biased. So what do you think of the portrayal of what's going on, both science, political, and how well do you think the Obama administration is doing on giving us the truth rather than, let's say what we want to hear because it is election time?
Well, I think that no matter what administration you've got in office, there are going to be people who are going to be skeptical of the information that's being released. There's a reflexive tendency we humans have whenever anybody stamps a secret on anything or does anything behind closed doors, the rest of us feel skeptical and suspicious about it. What's important is that, we do have a Freedom of Information Act. We have other mechanisms that have been promoted over the years primarily by us in the media as well as civil libertarians to make public access more easy and to protect whistleblowers who blow the whistle on government misconduct or alleged misconduct, etc. In recent years, both under Republicans and under Democrats, we have seen these laws rolled back or scaled back or argued back through court decisions. And while they are still there, I think we need to keep the pressure on to make sure that there's transparency in government.
And what about the truth? Where do you go to find the truth, Clarence?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, or as you quoted one of my columns earlier, we gather facts in order to find the truth. That's what journalists do. That's what I told my students when I was teaching journalism, and it is what we do every day because, you know, what is the truth of the Kennedy assassination, for example, the JFK's assassination? Polls each year tend to show that people believe less and less the prevailing story, which I believe, by the way. I believe Lee Harvey Oswald did act alone based on the evidence I've poured over. But there is so much other evidence brought up, so many different witness accounts and different kinds of, just so much has happened over the years. CBS does a new poll from time to time on what people think of the Kennedy assassination. The latest one I've seen showed like 7 out of 10 people do not believe that Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone and that the Warren Commission was correct, et cetera, et cetera. So we continue to gather facts, still trying to find the truth on something that happened how many years ago?
A long time ago. I was interested in, I don't know if you saw this news report or have read the book, Jackie Kennedy's Secret Service agent has just, after years and years of being depressed and drinking and smoking himself almost to death, he felt so guilty about not being able to protect the president that day. He was the guy who was climbing over the back of the car to get to them. He's written a book about his relationship with her. I thought it would be a good interview. And I don't know if you've seen the book, have you?
I've seen the book. I've heard about it, though. Yeah. And I there's this sympathy you feel for Secret Service people who risk their lives, and they really feel terrible after something like this happens. They feel personally responsible because they feel like they failed their mission. And my empathy and sympathies go out to all the people involved in that.
Well, why is it that I think that we're onto something here, that we're living in this time where we want to believe what somebody feeds to us, what they believe is the truth, and spare ourselves the rigors of trying to look at all points of view and do extensive reading on a particular topic. We just don't want to do that. We want to believe maybe in the sensational.
And we want to believe simple explanations. This is the basis of the paranoid theories that we hear popping out all the time. Or we want to believe a simple concept that comforts our prejudices. I put the whole notion that Barack Obama's birth certificate is a
phone. Oh my gosh! I know
that same category. I mean, here's a case where, in order to believe this, you have to believe the whole idea that he was really born in Kenya and was somehow smuggled in by people who faked a birth certificate back in. They would have had to have planned like in the late 50s that we need to find a mixed race baby that's going to be born about 1961 because in 2008 they've got a chance of being elected president. Nobody has come up with of all these theories. Nobody's come up with a reason why anybody would conspire in this fashion. Any theory, I'd like to hear something that somebody would come up with to explain why somebody would do this. And yet, these polls, the Mississippi primary here recently, polls showed something like, half of the Republican voters in Mississippi believe that Barack Obama was born in Kenya, or the birth certificate was phony, or that he was a secret Muslim. I mean, these kind of ideas. Sometimes I wonder if people really believe these theories, or if they say them as sort of a cultural marker. I'm a Southern conservative Christian evangelical, and I don't like Barack Obama, and that everything he represents is so foreign to me that he might as well not even be an American. And so when you cast doubt on the birth certificate, this is sort of your announcement. Hey, I'm one of those Americans. I'm a Donald Trump American. And Donald Trump, look at all the mileage he got out of simply questioning the birth certificate. Suddenly, he surged to the front of the Republican field, and he wasn't wasn't even announced as a candidate.
Such a complete and utter waste of our time. Such a complete waste of our time.
Indeed. People turn for emotional satisfaction, and they bend the facts in order to satisfy themselves.
Email from Trudy in Sheboygan. Do you think that the recall of Governor Scott Walker has national implications, and how far-reaching? If the recall is unsuccessful, how will it affect, or successful for that matter, how will it affect national politics?
It sends a signal, just like Scott Walker's election and his bold moves going beyond his mandate in the view of many Wisconsin folks in pushing against right of unions to organize and other drastic measures that he took that have resulted in this recall move. It gives encouragement to people in Ohio and other states in similar circumstances. And as with the rise of the Tea Party, it sends a signal that a lot of voters want to move back toward the center on these issues.
More phone calls in a moment. Clarence Page is our guest this hour. He is syndicated columnist, op-ed columnist for the Tribune Media Services editorial board as well, and national commentator TV on all kinds of stations on all kinds of issues. 800-486-8655, the number. Lines are open for you right now, as is the email, talk@WPR.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two, we talk about keeping libraries vital, alive, thriving for years and years and years and years to come. Dan in Fort Dodge, Iowa. Hi, Dan.
Good morning. I just thought I would remind the listeners that when it comes to all three of the pertinent Supreme Court cases we've talked about or have under consideration this morning, the power is still in the hands of the people, no matter how many people rail against activist judges. Capital United can be overruled, Roe v. Wade can be overruled, and whatever the decision is on Obamacare, that can be overruled by the people passing a constitutional amendment. I would suggest that we're going to have to start with Capital United, because the Congress is not in the hands of the people anymore. It's in the hands of money, and that's got to change.
I think you mean Citizens United?
Yes.
Right, indeed. He's right that the people have the ability to amend the Constitution to correct or change something that's been ruled as unconstitutional, if you will. Or in the case like the Obamacare issue, the whole question of the mandate wouldn't even have had to come up if they would have just if Congress and the White House had initially backed a tax or called it a tax instead of a mandate. And Justice Scalia said as much, that if it was a tax instead of a mandate, it would sail right through the constitutional question. But a reason why President Obama pushed for a mandate initially was because, as a candidate, he promised not to raise taxes. And so anything that sounds like a tax, he doesn't want to support, and the Republicans, of course, will oppose. And so this whole mandate issue was designed to get around that. So a lot of people want to dodge responsibilities here. If the whole health care question does go back to Congress, we're going to be back in the same mess we were in before, where both Republicans and Democrats agree something needs to be done in order to save programs like Medicare and Medicaid, which are not sustainable in the long run with their current fiscal structure. And at the same time, though, how do you pay for it? How do you pay for some kind of national health care coverage for everybody? How do you, whichever kind of system you want to come up with? And so Republicans have come up with a strong response to what Democrats have already passed. But your caller is absolutely right. One other problem, though, with constitutional amendments is that the public is very skeptical of them. They sound really great at first, but then when they start, take the Equal Rights Amendment for women, going back to the 1970s. Big, strong push initially, but one state after another, the more it was debated, the less enthusiastic the public got about any changes to the Constitution. So our system was designed to be slow, very sluggish, and it is proving to be just that.
Thanks, Dan, for the call. Willem in Colfax. Hi.
Hi. I just wonder sometimes if you know, Ronald Reagan's statement that the government is not the solution, that the government is the problem, and further actions like by Governor Scott Walker in Wisconsin about making the people who work for the state, that they're the problem, in a sense they're the enemy of the state, and the taxpayers, they're taking the taxpayers' dollars and, you know, we're paying for this and that, and this whole sort of divide and conquer strategy, when our Constitution really, you know, that the idea that the government, the representative of the people, that's who, you know, we are is, as a country, is the government, that somehow that has become not in service of the people, like the Constitution says, you know, to promote the general welfare, but to cause this divisive, you know, vibe in our state and in our country, that somehow the government is the enemy of the people. And I think that's very problematic.
Yeah, well, you know, we are a country that was founded on the notion the government's the enemy of the people. You know, the revolution, the language that we had back in those days, that Americans had in that revolutionary movement, were very much against power at the top and let's give more power to the people. In more recent times, as things have gotten more complicated, the public has been more willing to give more power to the executive branch and more authority. We have fought so many wars since World War II, yet we haven't had, World War II was the last constitutionally approved war, constitutionally approved by Congress. Since then, Congress has pretty much abdicated their right to declare war to the president. And so there's a this debate goes on, and I think that while, you know, people still say that they hate Congress, for example, when you ask them about their individual congressman or woman, they tend to like them. And so, and they feel the same way about the media, by the way. Everybody hates the media, quote unquote, but they've all got their favorite medium or their favorite broadcaster or their favorite commentator or somebody that they turn to. So I think, you know, I always kind of keep my tongue in cheek a little bit when I talk about this uprising of people against the government, because when you run into a crisis like 9/11, it's amazing how suddenly unified we Americans become. But we certainly don't want to have a crisis like 9/11 happening every month.
Yeah. Thank you, Willem, for your call. Did you know Mike Wallace, Clarence?
Yeah, I knew him quite well, I'm happy to say, because...
Oh, you did?
I was a fellow judge with him on something called the Livingston Awards for Young Journalists for about the last 20, 25 years. Hmm. I've been on that, and Mike helped to start that award and fund it. He did a lot of things like this on the side to help encourage young journalists. He sponsored the Knight Wallace Fellowship at the University of Michigan, his alma mater. Which also encourages young working journalists to do additional study and all. And he was really a great guy, real old school. And without going into the long story about it, he brought Malcolm X and Louis Farrakhan their first national exposure back in 1959 with a documentary on the Muslims called The Hate That Hate Produced, when Mike was with Channel 13, the PBS station in New York. And Louis Lomax, a great black journalist at the time, brought this story to him. And it was Mike loaned me his own only copy of this documentary, and I copied it and gave him the original back, and was very honored with this, because it's a real classic to see this. That Mike was so far ahead of that story, and like he was so far ahead on so many stories over the years. And he's been ill for about the last 4 or 5 years. He hasn't really gotten out much. Mm-hmm. He died at age 92, but he was working right up till the strength went out of his legs. I can tell you that.
Mm. Do you want to do that too? Do you want to keep working? keep working?
I can't imagine not working, but, you know, my idea of retirement is having the ability to do what you want to do rather than what you have to do.
Yes.
You know, there's a lot of writing and reporting I would like to do, but I need the time and the money to be able to do it. And so if I can get retired from my regular work, but still, I can't imagine giving up the column without it being snatched away from me. I still enjoy that so much. So, I think you got to drag me out with wet feet first, like so many other columnists in the past.
Well, may no one ever snatch the column away from you, Clarence. That
thank
would be
you.
A
Thank
tragedy.
You, Kathy. I appreciate that.
Yeah,
thank
you're entirely,
much.
Entirely welcome. Always a great pleasure to speak with you, Clarence. Thank you so
you
much for being with us. Clarence Page joining us from the studios of NPR this hour for All Things Political. He, of course, is a nationally syndicated columnist. You can Google his name and find a lot of very interesting columns on Trayvon Martin and To Kill a Mockingbird and the Affordable Health Care Act. And, well, he writes twice a week, so you can get his columns on a number of different issues. And you also see him pretty regularly on TV, on PBS, and also on MSNBC and other channels. We thank him for his time. An analysis of all things political, which you always hear Mondays at 9 here on the Ideas Network. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, and thanks to Rhonda Fanning as well for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. We have news coming up, and then we'll have another whole hour of conversation. I hope you'll join us as we talk about the future of libraries.